I'm very happy now to welcome Brian Burns. He's president and CEO of the Santa Fe Community Foundation. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me again, Mary Charlotte. So nice to be here.
Nice to be here. It's nice to catch up with our various nonprofits and people who support those nonprofits. Tell us a little bit about what the Santa Fe Community Foundation is about.
Sure. Well, a community foundation is a collection of funds that are established by values-driven donors throughout the community. They work with us to help them make the most out of their giving. And we then, in turn, help nonprofits throughout the community achieve their missions with excellence by providing them with everything from technical assistance and training to grants to help to support their important work.
What are some of the kind of projects you're involved with now?
Well, we have a number of things we've been involved with. As you know, this is a community with enormous needs, so we're always looking at where we might have the greatest impact. Some examples of some recent grants we've made. We recently challenged the city of Santa Fe to match a $60,000 commitment on our part to support a manager at the Resource and Opportunity Center, homeless Resource and Opportunity Center down on Osirios Road, the old Pete's Pets, project.
Right.
The city was very generous a few years ago in getting that project going with the funding of the building. But so many great organizations are using it that there was a real need for a coordinator there, kind of a traffic cop in some ways, so that the organizations could be efficient in what they were doing. And there was no funding for that in the city's funding. So we decided to challenge the city, and the Chile city recently met our challenge. So we now have been able to fund for the next 3 years a manager for the Resource and Opportunity Center. So that seems like a good use of our resources, and we love partnering with other funders. Another thing, as many people know, marriage equality is in the news these days a lot. About a year ago, the Community Foundation convened interested donors in that issue. And from that, a marriage equality task force was formed, and that group has been very busy raising money to support marriage equality efforts here in New Mexico. And this year, they announced the first, this week actually, they announced the first installment of a series of grants. This first installment is $40,000 to support the work of the ACLU in New Mexico and the EQNM, Equality New Mexico Group, and the All Family Matters Coalition, who are working very hard right now to win marriage equality for New Mexicans. So that was a very exciting grant that we made this past week.
I think it's extraordinary how quickly this issue has moved. After decades and decades of activism, somehow it's sort of like the flower opened and everybody pretty much everybody gets it now.
That's how change happens, though, I think. You know, there's that, maybe we've all read Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point. You know, what kind of momentum has to get going and gets to pick up before you hit that tipping point where it blossoms?
Yeah.
And so it does seem like we're at a turning point with this issue, and it's good to see. It's rewarding. Yeah.
We'll see if the Supreme Court thinks so.
Well, we'll see, and if not this time around, so eventually. It seems to me that all indicators are it's going to go in the direction of justice and fairness and civil rights at some point.
In the not too long run.
Right.
And so you have another initiative involving property crime and drugs here in Santa Fe.
Well, this is actually an initiative of the Drug Policy Alliance and the city. We're happy to be partners with them in what they're calling the LEAD Project, which stands for the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program. And this is trying to solve a very troubling dynamic in Santa Fe. There are, unfortunately, people in the community who are addicted to opioid-based drugs, so heroin and methamphetamines. And there has nationally, been a relationship between those who use those opiate-based substances and crime, because the addictive power of those drugs is so strong. Here in Santa Fe, we estimate that there are about 100 opioid users who are responsible for about 80% of the property crime in Santa Fe. And much to, you know, I think I really want to congratulate Emily Kaltenbach and the Drug Policy Alliance in pulling together a very diverse group of players in the city. Corrections leaders, law enforcement, city leaders, the mayor is on this task force, we at the Community Foundation, treatment advocates, medical providers, and we're all trying to figure out how to address this issue. What we've decided to do is explore the possibility of importing a model that's been piloted now in Seattle that offers offenders at the moment of being picked up, all right, an opportunity to go into intensive treatment and intensive and effective treatment so that they kind of break the cycle of their addiction, and therefore we see this reduction in property crime. So it's going to take partnership across the full range of service providers, from corrections and law enforcement to treatment advocates in the community. Our job in this is to, right now, we've just begun doing a cost-benefit analysis. So what would it actually cost to put that kind of a program on the ground? And what would the financial benefit be to the community? And what is the human benefit as well?
Yeah, I was going to say.
Right. But, you know, we have to look at all those parts.
Yeah.
And so once that study's done, we will then kind of begin looking for national funding to pilot the project for a number of years and develop a sustainability plan. Of course, we'd evaluate very carefully the success of this kind of a model. But I am really proud of this community for stepping up and recognizing this is a real need and that there's a compassionate and smart way to deal with this problem.
Yeah, it's such an interesting problem because when you look at, I mean, I don't know anything about methamphetamine except what I've learned on Breaking Bad, which I couldn't even get through because it was so intense. But it is a really, really nasty drug. And when we talk on this program, which we do often, about drug legalization, and, you know, marijuana is pretty much a no-brainer, and everybody, almost everybody gets it at this point, that it really is a non-dangerous drug. And I personally think it should be prescribed to all domestic violence abusers because it cuts down on people's violent tendencies. But when you talk about drugs that make you violent just by their nature, is it better that they be legalized? That's a big question. Do the people who are using them want treatment? What are these people's lives like that they're taking it? They're huge questions. I don't know the answer.
I don't know that anyone really knows the answer. I think what we have to do is be putting our heads together and using, you know, all the best research at our disposal to make the best decisions possible with the scarce resources we have to address these things. And I think it's really important to remember that these are real people. You know, they're people with hearts and souls and lives and loves and families, and we have to deal with them compassionately. And we also have to ensure that the community's safe for everyone. So I think we have to always find a way to balance these two things.
We're talking to Brian Burns of the Santa Fe Community Foundation. Now, you are doing work that involves the Santa Fe Public Schools.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, we had last summer, maybe folks remember, Robert Knott did a series of articles in the New Mexican about poverty in the schools. And it was quite troubling because I think there's a whole segment of Santa Fe that doesn't understand, in fact, how challenged many of the students are who go to Santa Fe Public Schools. Just, you know, we have numerous schools, maybe it's 7 or 8 of the schools in Santa Fe where nearly 100% of the students qualify for free and reduced lunch, which is the indicator for poverty. Huge amount of poverty in this community. And we need to understand, we started with a series of questions about how do we understand the impact of that poverty on children's ability to learn, on the ability of the school system to meet their needs. And Robert raised a series of poignant questions in his article. So we started convening community leaders, nonprofit folks, foundations, other donors, over the course of the fall and into the winter to try to wrap our minds around this. And our thinking and our understanding of the problem evolved so that earlier this winter, we did a study looking at the philanthropic investment in the public schools. We wanted to understand where are our current resources going? And so we did this study called the Philanthropic Funding in Santa Fe Public Schools, and we looked at about $3 million worth of philanthropy that was donated or granted into the public school system over the course of the last year. So it's a real moment in time snapshot. And we noticed some very interesting patterns to it. One is, maybe to no one's surprise, there isn't a clear strategy collectively around all of the philanthropy that's going into the public schools. Individual foundations and individual donors might have their own special interest, you know, and their own strategy, but there's very little coordination among all the funders. And maybe there's an opportunity in this for us to coordinate better behind a clear strategy to improve schools. But we noticed some interesting trends when you look at the $3 million that we looked at in aggregate. And it's not all the funding that's in the schools, but it was a good sampling of a lot of the funding that's in the schools. But one of the patterns is...
When you say funding, you mean private funding.
Private funding, right. And just so you know, the superintendent says it's about $10 million in discretionary dollars in the schools, and private philanthropy is putting in about $3 million. So this is a significant portion.
What's
of
the other $7 million?
It's from public sources. So federal money and others. So this is outside of teacher salaries and buildings, money that's going into programs and academic enrichment and all that kind of stuff. So this is a significant, so we have to recognize that this is a place where philanthropy can potentially have a lot of influence because we have a significant portion of the discretionary dollars that are going to the schools.
But why should public schools, which are public, receive even a penny from philanthropy? It seems like they should be publicly funded. I mean, when I went to school as a child and in our generation, there was no philanthropy in the public schools, and we had fabulous programs. We had music and art and PE and science and everything else.
Yeah. This is a very challenging question, and it's actually a good point of debate. Many people feel that private philanthropy should not be backfilling for what government should be doing.
Yeah.
It's not the best use of the philanthropic dollar. I used to feel that way very strongly and was a strong advocate for that point of view. In recent years, and in communities that are so stressed, like the Santa Fe community is, I think we do have an obligation to wisely invest in the schools in places and in ways that the school maybe currently can't. And so I'm not so clear anymore that there's such a bright line division between what the public what public funding should be supporting and what philanthropy should be supporting. At the same time, I want to say that I think the unique value add, value proposition for philanthropy is that we're contributing to kind of the R&D arm of society, that we should be actually out front doing bold things, challenging the status quo, advancing society, changing policy. You know, those are the real places where philanthropy should be used.
And you're always, when you do that, you're always living inside of a tension, namely that you have, you know, the 1%, quote unquote, as
right.
we call that sector of society, that is providing the money, and it's in their interest not to have the status quo change.
Well, yes and no, but, you know, you look, it's all about kind of the size of the system you're looking at. You look globally, and, you know, the United States is the 1%. The whole United States is the 1%. You know, so what system are we looking at? I have not liked that division about the 1% and the 99% in the context of philanthropy so much, because I think that there's something quite elegant about the American tradition of philanthropy. Is, you know, on the one hand, we have an economic system where people can accumulate wealth. That's what our system delivers. Those people who are accumulating wealth are offered the opportunity to redistribute that wealth through philanthropy. And I think while it's an imperfect system, we are the most philanthropic country in the United States.
Because we don't fund our public schools.
In the world.
I mean, because we don't fund our arts, we don't fund our social services, we don't have a safety net. I mean, I wonder if we had a really properly functioning government that provided the services the governments are supposed to provide, whether we would have to be so focused on philanthropy. I mean, I'm sorry, this is what you do, but...
Well, it's all a valid debate to be had, and I think we have to be careful. The government does... We can't say absolutely they don't fund this and don't fund that, don't fund the arts. Government funding does go to those things.
Just insufficiently.
Whether it might be insufficient, it might be inadequate, it might not be nimble enough, it might not be bold enough or risky enough. So I think there's a debate, but I think, yeah, so... philanthropy is unique money in society, and we should use it very carefully. And I think that's my point in the Santa Fe Public Schools is right now, I don't believe collectively we have a clear intention about what we're trying to do with our local philanthropic investment. I mean, certainly Lanel Foundation knows what they're trying to do, and McCune Foundation and New Mexico Community Foundation. We all are contributing from our individual points of view. But collectively, I don't think we have a clear intention. And that's my hope in doing the studies, that we might be able to come together and think about how do we strategically deploy $3 million of philanthropic capital into the public school system in a way that really changes something. And how do we work in partnership with a superintendent and a school district that is increasingly clear about a strategy for change? And so I think that's where we have to both be smart and assess whether or not that strategy is a good one, and then we have to think about where we deploy our capital.
Now, do you study, we're talking to Brian Burns of the Santa Fe Community Foundation, do you take a look at states like Massachusetts or whatever that have really high-functioning public schools and see how they do it?
Well, I think what we're looking at, I mean, we're still at the beginning of this project, so what we're looking at is... how have other communities deployed philanthropic capital for change? And I often point to two examples from around the country, and they're very different ones. In Boston, for example, and many people know, the Boston Public Schools for many years were really problematic. And a number of years ago, the Boston Foundation, their local community foundation, a very large community foundation, however, decided that they would, rather than invest in the public schools, they would actually invest in a parallel alternative system of charter schools in order to create a competitive environment. And in fact, they seem, over the last decade, 15 years, seem to have achieved some significant success with that approach. Now, when they took that approach, it was very carefully thought out. They really understood the landscape. They organized the other funders. You know, there's a lot of work that goes into choosing that kind of a path.
And also, what happens to the kids who aren't in the charter schools?
Well, that's the thing. They really created a system where charter schools were accessible to kids who, you know, whose parents wanted to get them out. But you're right. There's, you know, you're going to, and one of the hard things in philanthropy is that while you're trying to affect change, people continue to suffer. So it requires a kind of patience in being able to sit with that suffering while you're aggressively pursuing a change theory. And that's one of the, you know, I often say people's lives depend on what we're doing, and we have to be able to bear witness to that suffering as we're trying to affect change. That's one of the hard things. The other example is from the Pittsburgh public school system. And similarly, the Pittsburgh philanthropic community observed that there was a high degree of dysfunction among the school board, the superintendents, the administration of the school district, etc. And the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Heinz Foundations, I believe even their local United Way, all decided to use their voices to influence change. So they came together and said, okay, we've tried to affect change from the inside. We're kind of tired of that. We're now going to pull all of the grant making we do from into the public schools out. And we're no longer going to do grants for public education until you guys get your act together. And there's a great article in the Stanford Social Innovation Review about this, maybe written maybe 5 or 7 years ago, called Leading Boldly. And the upshot of their intervention, their activism, was in fact, after there was lots of screaming and yelling and wringing of hands, how could you possibly do that? Within a couple years, in fact, the superintendent got replaced, the school board got replaced, the school started to turn around, and the foundation stepped back in with their money. So it was only 10% of the discretionary budget of the school, so it wasn't even that big, but it was their voice and their influence that they used to really force change to happen.
And that was what forced those changes?
That is what forced those changes.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, there are examples where philanthropy can work either with or against public systems to affect change. And I think this, you know, again, this is the way we have to think strategically about philanthropic investments.
It's such an important issue in New Mexico. I was talking to somebody the other day who works in healthcare, and I said, why isn't Santa Fe a national center for geriatric medicine? Mm-hmm. It's very hard for a lot of older people to even get a doctor's appointment, and it seems like because there's such a large community of retired people here, there should be fantastic geriatric medicine. And the person said to me, it's because when those really leading doctors are looking at where they want to set up their careers, they want to go to places where there's good public schools because they've got school-aged kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the major reasons. And when you think about attracting people to New Mexico, and you think about economic development, and you think about kids coming out of school and going into the workforce, I mean, all of those factors, that basically education is what's holding us back in so many different ways.
Yeah, I think we can. I think there are actually three pillars to what makes a community viable and kind of a vibrant place to live. One is we have to take care of our neediest. You know, I think that's a bottom line. Like, we have to make sure that people in the community don't have to live in destitute situations and destitution. So basic human needs is one of those pillars. A second pillar, I think, is education that's accessible and available to everyone, that's of high quality. Because that obviously, as you're saying, kind of lays the groundwork for a future workforce, to attract folks to live here, obviously connected, and let alone the basic human right to have a good education. And then the third is around economic vibrancy. And obviously these three things are interrelated. You can't really have economic vibrancy without an educated populace. You know, you can't have a civically engaged community without having an educated community. So yeah, I think we have to think very systemically about this problem of education, not look at it in a silo, but in the context of the health and well-being and vibrancy of the entire community.
There's always a question with education, which is the amount of funding, whether teachers are being paid sufficiently. And I was reading an article about Finland, which has the best educational system in the whole world if you go on the basis of test scores, and how they educate their teachers, and their teachers are trained very, very intensely over a period of 6 years, and they get paid, they're treated basically as if they were the professionals on the level of doctors and lawyers. And of course, we don't have that here. It's almost like a pretty low working class job to be a teacher, and so there is the issue of money, but there's also the issue of what actually happens in the classroom.
Yeah.
And that is a very tricky issue to deal with, because you can put all the curricula that you want, but how those are used and whether the students are bored or engaged is basically the bottom line.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, we have to look at it like we look at other professions. For me personally, for example, you know, I have opportunities for ongoing professional development. You know, I'm able to attend national conferences and classes and leadership development opportunities and take advantage of those things. And those things really make a difference in my ability to perform. The other is, while we have fair compensation and use national standards for it, it's also important that, you know, success is compensated for. And I think that, yeah, we have to think in that way, in this system, you know, that incentivizes success. And you know, it's not really in my purview to understand how the teachers and all are paid. That's not, you know, I don't think that's really where the philanthropic dollars should be spent necessarily. But I do think the superintendent here, and in fact superintendents all over the country, are really struggling with this question of how do we really value the folks who are in the classroom responsible for educating our children.
Right. And
And hold them accountable at the same time.
And hold them accountable at the same time, yeah. And see if they're really working a 40-hour week or whether they're expected to take home hours and hours of paper grading at night and all those kinds of things.
Right.
I mean, hugely important. Now, when we talk about philanthropic dollars spent here in New Mexico, in Santa Fe, how are they spent?
Yeah, interestingly, one of the things we learned was there's very, very little philanthropic capital at work in high schools or middle schools. A small amount in the middle school, really nearly none in the high school. So there's a real bias, and maybe, I don't think we've been intentional about this, and I don't know whether we want to rethink it, but right now most of the money's going into elementary schools. The second thing we notice is if you look at the superintendent's strategy, he has three types of schools. Three zones: innovation, which are the high-performing schools; acceleration, which are the moderately well-performing schools; and then transformation, which are the low-performing schools.
Euphemisms.
They are. Every need to capture the attention of your reader somehow. But anyway, he uses a very helpful set of criteria to determine which schools fall into which zone, and it makes some logical sense. If you look at where the nonprofits in this community are funded to work and where we are making grants as a philanthropic community, you'll notice that the vast amount of money is going into the highest performing schools. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Maybe they are one of the reasons they're high performing is because there's been a significant and sustained philanthropic investment in those schools. But what we also see is that the lowest performing schools, the transformation schools, are getting the least amount of philanthropic support. And the types of support is different in each of these. So the high-performing schools are getting funded to provide academic programming. The low-performing schools, with their small amount of philanthropic capital, are being funded to offer enrichment programs.
What are those?
Like non-academic stuff. So the dance course, the music course, the phys ed course, which of course are critically important to the well-rounded education of a student. So what we have is a Swiss cheese picture here. There are lots of holes in the system.
Now, the high-performing schools, maybe they already have their dance and music and PE programs?
Mm-hmm. It could be. Now, we also, however, there's just significantly more money going into those schools as well. So I think, we don't want to take money away from the high-performing schools. What we want to figure out is how do we support the low-performing schools better and in a way that strategically helps them climb into another zone. And so I think that's the next level of our work, is to understand what are the best investments, how do we attract additional capital, and how do we develop a really clear theory of change here that moves schools from the transformation zone up into acceleration, and hopefully someday where all of us can enjoy schools that are all at the innovation level.
Now, are you talking to teachers?
Yeah, so teachers have participated in the convenings up to this point as well. We're working very closely with the superintendent's office to understand his strategy and how do we look at the relationship of philanthropy to his strategy. So there's a lot of good partnership at this point. I don't see us in an adversarial role right now. I think we have an opportunity for tremendous partnership. I think we, the Community Foundation, has an opportunity to actually be helpful to the school district at this point. And we also have an opportunity to organize the nonprofits that are working in our schools and the different funding institutions that are working in the schools. So that's the hope going forward. We still have more research we need to do, though, too. Like, our next step is going to be looking at the transformation schools, those low-performing schools. We want to understand what kind of public funding is in there as well. So our next step, which hopefully will be done by June, is to do the full funding picture of the transformation schools in this community. So how much philanthropy is in there and what's it doing? How much Title I money and other kinds of public support are in those schools? And what's the full and complete picture? Because we need that before we can decide what kind of intervention to create.
Yeah, I mean, and when you talk about the place where you started was poverty in the schools and people, you've got schools where 100% of the children are eligible for subsidized meals and things like that. you've got a much bigger problem, which is, poverty at home,
yeah.
stressed parents, sometimes violence, sometimes drugs,
right.
and things that the school can only, in a small way, even begin to address.
Yeah, but even a small way might help. So, for example, there's an effort afoot to expand what used to be called the Salazar Partnership at the Salazar School, which is kind of a social service hub for students there that help them address their various social service needs. So there's at least some baseline of stability and security in these kids' homes so that they could then attend to school. And Salazar Partnership recently partnered with a national organization called Communities in Schools, which does a very similar thing in a very organized, highly evaluated way. And the superintendent and the philanthropic community are trying to figure out how do we take this Communities in Schools models and get it into the transformation schools. And that's one of the priorities that Joel Boyd has talked about. We really like what we see in Communities in Schools. We think there's good leadership there as well. And we think that might be one of the paths forward in trying to address this, the complex social service needs, at least at a basic level for the students who are in these low-performing schools. Because one of the patterns we notice is while it's not a rule per se, but there's a tendency that the lower-performing schools are, in fact, the poorer schools. It's not a rule in every case, but there's certainly that tendency. So we do know that unmet basic needs do interfere with a child's ability to learn.
We're talking to Brian Burns of the Santa Fe Community Foundation. Let's talk a little bit more about the foundation. I mean, mm-hmm. this is a institution with a big endowment, a significant budget, and it gives away quite a lot of money every year.
Mm-hmm. So, we've been experiencing a lot of growth in the past 3 years, which we are very grateful for. It's a sign that the philanthropic community here is willing to step up and really invest. Last year, 2012, we accepted $23 million in new gifts from donors throughout this community. Our total assets now, so that means the money that we manage, is over $60 million. And last year we gave away $4 million, and I believe this year it'll be significantly more than that because of the growth we've experienced. The vast amount of the money that we manage is, of course, donor-advised money. So it really reflects the interests of the donors who use us. And, in fact, we're very pleased that the donors who use us really care about helping meet basic human needs in this community, supporting a healthy environment, promoting arts and cultural heritages here, and supporting education. So we have a lot of partnerships with our individual donors. So yeah, we're in a very fortunate position. And I do think, you know, we've seen significant growth in the Community Foundation, and I hope that that continues into the future, because as we grow, we have greater and greater flexibility to do more in the community. It also gives us a more influential voice when it comes time to really think about how to represent the interests of those who might not have a voice in this community. So,
Brian Burns is president and CEO of the Santa Fe Community Foundation. Thank you so much for being with us.
I really appreciate being here. It's always a lovely time.
I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Linda Marianello. She is translator of the book Gertrude Kolmar, A Literary Life. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. Pleasure to be with you.
So you will be speaking about this book and introducing it tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Who was Gertrude Kolmar? I'd never heard of her, an amazing German poet.
Yes, it's just incredible that she's only becoming more well-known now. Incredible in the sense that Dieter Kuhn, the author, the German author of this work, believes she may have been one of the greatest poets of the German language of all time, but most certainly one of the greatest 20th century German poets. Sadly, not much of her work was published during her lifetime, and she died in Auschwitz. Several members of her family, several siblings and cousins managed to escape Germany before the final solution in 1942. They went to South America, they went to Australia, England, Some went to Paris. But in any case, they preserved her work. Otherwise, it would have been lost to us forever.
Now, she was one of those people who was very quiet and very modest about her poetry. She was, I guess, the opposite of what we might call a self-promoter.
Absolutely. In fact, she abhorred calling attention to herself in any way, and I'd like to read a little portion of the book that talks about that. In Finkenkrug, the image of a nondescript, indeed emphatically nondescript, person was firmly established. As a child, Gertrude had placed little value on pretty clothes, something her mother occasionally complained about. She wrote the most modest, she wore, excuse me, the most modest old-fashioned looking raiment. The poet hid, as it were, behind the little woman who, upon seeing her, would more likely remind you of the nice auntie next door than a lyricist who wrote world-class poetry, sister to an Akhmatova or Tsvetaeva.
And that's some good company. Now, she was born at the end of the 19th century, and she was from a prosperous family. Her father was a lawyer, and she had quite a number of tragic occurrences even before the Holocaust. She had a man she was in love with who then went into World War I and lost his mind.
Yes, he did. He had a complete breakdown, and actually the written record remains silent on it to some extent, so Dieter Kuhn speculates about what the specific details of it were, but what we do know is that before he went to war that they did have an intimate relationship and she became pregnant. And so then after he went off to war and had a complete breakdown, it became clear that really there was no option of their getting married. And so her family, Kuhn believes that her family pressured her to have an abortion, and she did indeed go through with it, although it was a huge trauma that affected her for the rest of her life.
And found its way into her poetry.
Yes, it did. In fact, there's a poem called End or Ending, Ende in German, and it's the last poem in her early cycle, which he calls Cycle 3. I'd like to read a little bit of that. And it has to do with the end of her relationship with this man, who she apparently did not hold any ill will towards. If I am seriously sad, I can no longer write verses. I sit silently in a boat and let it float me downstream. I will not find a rudder. I will not need a helm. If my love, my sorrow wants it so, I will capsize and sink. If I am in deep despair, I cannot moderately ponder. My cry is shrill and harried. Should I grab and restrain him? Never more shall my ragged thoughts be smooth, shiny lines. My heart is a bloody pulp, and I can neither shape nor polish anything.
We're talking about the poet Gertrude Kolmar, and the book is called Gertrude Kolmar, A Literary Life. Let's just digress to you for a moment. How did you come in contact with her and with this book to the point where you became the translator from German to English?
An excellent question. We used to live in Chicago, and there's a wonderful Goethe Institute in Chicago that I was very actively involved with. The man who was in charge of the Goethe Institute at that time was a great lover of literature and a huge supporter of the translation of works in German into English. And in fact, the annual Wolf Prize is awarded there. So I attended a number of the Wolf seminars and the prize ceremonies, at which point I met Henry Carrigan, who is the head of Northwestern University Press. He's their editor-in-chief, and he asked me if I'd be interested in translating this work, which came to our attention at that particular seminar.
How did you learn German?
Well, initially I studied it as an undergrad at Yale College, and then after I finished my master's degree, I moved to Germany and worked there. I'm a professional musician, a flutist, which is my other hat that I wear, and I lived there for over 10 years. Studied German also for my master's degree and passed my language requirements toward the masters in German. And then we got into translation, mainly in the music field initially. When I say we, I'm also speaking about Franz Vogt, who's my husband and business partner. And so I've been translating in the music field and interpreting since 1990, and been more actively involved in literary translation and arts translation since about the early 2000s.
Translating from the German is tricky. It's, even though the languages have so many cognates, it's such a different feel and different kind of sentence structure.
Totally. And modern German has also tended to prize complexity over clarity. And so I don't find that that's particularly true of Dieter Kuhn. His thoughts and his perceptions are extremely insightful, and I think he truly wishes to communicate, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily easy to always understand what he wanted. And so I felt particularly fortunate to have worked with him on the translation, and we communicated by email if I had questions about anything or wasn't sure just what he meant.
Very interesting. So back to the poet Gertrude Kolmar, and the book is called Gertrude Kolmar, A Literary Life. She was a woman who was very well educated, particularly for her time. Was it unusual for a woman to have the education that she did?
Yes, it was unusual in the sense that after women normally would have completed what we might consider middle school, they would often have no further educational opportunities. But her parents saw to it that she had private educational opportunities after she completed those early secondary levels of education. So she had what we might even consider the equivalent of a university education today. And she put that to use by being a tutor in private homes for a number of years before she eventually ended up living with her parents for the remainder of her life, taking care of them, and also being a secretary to her father's law practice.
Tell us more about her father, because he was a major part of her life and development.
He certainly was. His name was Ludwig Kotzisner, and it might be important to know that Gertrude Kolmar is generally called Kolmar today because her father originally had a publisher friend who published her first book of poetry. And rather than using the name Kotzisner, which was more difficult to pronounce, her father, substituted the name Kolmar, which had to do with the city that their family was from in what is now Poland.
Right. A number of people have done that. The German artist Georg Baselitz named himself after the town that he was from.
Exactly. And by the way, she didn't like the name Kolmar. And so later on in her life, some of her later poems were published under her real name.
So she died in her 40s in Auschwitz. Some of her family survived. They went to other countries. A sister went to Switzerland. A brother was in Australia. But she and her parents all died in Germany.
That's correct. Actually, her mother died before the end of the war. She died of cancer, and Gertrude took care of her in the last years of her life.
And so how has her legacy been discovered and brought to the world?
Well, there have been a number of important figures, I think, who were responsible for that, chiefly her brother-in-law, Peter Wenzel. Peter was married to her sister, Hilda, and they did divorce after the Second World War, but Hilda went to Switzerland and stayed there throughout the war with their daughter, Sabina Wenzel. And Peter stayed in Germany. He continued to work throughout the war. He was not at any time involved in the Nazi Party or a member of the party. They had originally owned a bookstore in Berlin, but they were forced to close it before the end of the war. And he took some type of less prestigious job to get himself through the war and to just manage to survive. And then afterwards, he was connected with S. Fischer, the publisher in Frankfurt, for example, and he ensured that a lot of Gertrude Kolmar's poetry was then published after the end of the war posthumously.
She seems to me like almost a kind of Emily Dickinson, who during her life was completely unknown, and then after her death, all of this work kind of came to light and to the rest of us. And is it well known in Germany at this point?
I think it's only really starting to become known. There are a number of people who now specialize in her work, and there have been a number of conferences about her work and her poetry that have taken place that I've received emails about. People try to keep us in the loop. There's a great deal of interest in Germany right now in the English translations of the poetry that are published in this book.
Now, Gertrude Kolmar lived through and died in a concentration camp, as we've said. Did she respond in her poetry to the Nazi terrorism?
She did, and there were various circumstances in her life. For example, her cousin Georg Benjamin was imprisoned because he was a communist. He was a doctor. He worked with the poor in Berlin, and he was arrested and put in jail early on. And Dieter Kuhn believes that there may be a connection between that circumstance and the poem, The Abuse, that she wrote. I'd like to read that because I think it's very significant that she wrote this at a time when she literally could have been killed for having written it if it had been discovered. In my cell, the light burns all night. I stand by the wall, daring not to sleep. For every 10 minutes, a guard comes to look at me. I keep watch at the wall. His shirt is brown. The others come back, talking among themselves. They laugh at my cries and moans. They stretch my arms forcefully, calling it sport. My knees give out. Finally, they leave. I did not see trees, sun. Are there any, really? Or a place where a poor child still loves his father? Not a sign, no letter. Yet I still have a wife. They said, "You're red. We'll beat you black and blue." They used rods of steel for whipping, and my body was just, "Oh God, oh God." No, no, I am not religious. I've never prayed in the field, in the hospital, just evenings as a young boy with mother sitting on the bed. The earth is the crypt of a prison, the sky a blue hole. Do you hear me? I deny you. My God, ah, help me anyway. You are not. For if you were, you'd have taken pity on me. Jesus suffered for all of you. I suffer for myself alone. I stand caving in with water and some bread for hours and hours. How good death is. Lying down, enclosed in a deep dark shaft, no glaring lights, just sleep, just silence, night.
Poetry of Gertrude Kolmar. Now, you translated the book about her life, but not the poetry itself.
That's
Those are kind of
correct.
Different tasks.
They're completely different tasks, and my translation partner, Franz Vogt, translated the poetry. I think he did a wonderful job. I really love it. And I think it does capture the feeling behind the original German text.
Do you want to, it's almost time to go, but do you want to end with one more poem before we go?
I would love to, and I'd like to read this poem because it closes the work, and it's Dieter Kuhn's way of saying goodbye to her rather than just writing about her death in a gas chamber. And we have proceeded through the gallows and the rack. When I die, I just want to rest. My face turned inward. I turn my face to the east. When I am dead, my name will hover for a while above the world. The blue twilight descends heavy with moisture. Then I flew into your nest of mane, held on tightly with my mouth and claws, and could no longer sing. Those who walk about here are but bodies. When I am dead, may I still be found somewhere among fences behind fields. I wrap the night around me like a warm sheet. When I am dead, heart and loins fade. What held me and kept me moving steps aside, and only the night listening. I love you, my people. The table, bed, wardrobe, and whatever is there, day, the forest, love, all that was.
Again, the poetry of Gertrude Kolmar. The book is called Gertrude Kolmar, A Literary Life, translated from the German by Linda Marinello. It's originally by Dieter Kuhn. And you will be reading tonight at Collected Works Bookstore.
Yes, we will, in honor of Holocaust Remembrance Day. And this is also co-sponsored by the Yale Club of New Mexico.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Loved it. Thanks very much, Mary Charlotte.